DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. My name is Connor Dillon. In our show today, you are going to learn how to avoid becoming addicted to opioids. We're going to hear about a strange intersection of time, politics, and health in the EU. I'm going to introduce you to a German agency you've probably never heard about before. And finally, you're even going to learn that trees have gender. Yes, gender. And why that matters in the autumn, in the Northern Hemisphere anyway. All that and much, much more right here on Spectrum. The US President Donald Trump recently announced that the United States has a health emergency in the form of an opioid crisis. And the general argument that's being pushed around right now is that powerful prescription drugs have directly led to the tripling of drug use deaths due to drugs like heroin over the last two decades in the United States. But is that true? Is it the direct result of powerful prescription drugs? I sat down with Lukas Radbruch. He's the chair of palliative medicine at the University of Bonn. He's the director of the palliative care at the Malteser Hospital. And he's the president of the International Association for Hospice and Palliative Care. My first question for him was whether Germans per capita are consuming fewer opioid painkillers than Americans.
Not really. It's not that much less. So the amount per capita for the whole population would be lower than the US, but it's not that much lower. It's more than half of what the US uses. So you can't say that it's only a matter of not giving out painkillers at all. Obviously, we seem to use them in a more appropriate way or to patients that benefit more from them. I checked before for the Lancet Commission about the number of opioid deaths, and the official statistic in Germany says that in 2015 there have been 220 deaths from opioid overdose for a population of 82 million. At the same year in the US, there have been 33,000 opioid overdose deaths. So that shows the difference. And as I said, the amount per capita used is not that much less.
So let's say we have two different individuals involved in a car accident, and as a result, they suffer chronic pain. One of them lives in the United States, the other lives in Germany. How would both of these two people experience their pain treatment, their palliative care, differently in these two countries?
Well, perhaps we start with the car accident and not the chronic pain. So what would happen is actually that the patient probably would need intensive care or at least lots of medical treatment. And he might suffer from severe pain, acute pain as that, and he would get opioids in the US as well as in Germany. And he would need that also for the acute phase of the pain. In Germany, he probably would see a doctor very regularly. He would be in, if he would be in intensive care, he would really be in a good medical environment. And people would taper down the pain management according to his needs, and he probably would be off the opioids in about 2 weeks' time. In the US, he might get discharged from hospital and he might get a prescription for, say, about 4 weeks with opioid pain medicines. You don't really know whether he needs that for that time because he might not be able to see a doctor in that time or only very infrequently, but he would have the prescription and he would use the opioids probably for that period of time. If pain persists, he would get refills in the US and he probably would stay on the pain medicine for as long as he wants. And there's probably nobody who really asks him about whether it's really useful anymore. He probably wouldn't have money to get any more medical assessment, medical investigation, or to get a comprehensive pain management treatment. In Germany, at some time, the physician would stop the medicine, and he would definitely try to see whether the patient could do without. If not, he probably would try to enter him into a chronic pain treatment plan, would present him to a pain management specialist pain clinic. Usually that starts about half a year after the accident. If the pain still persists at that time, he probably would be eligible for specialist pain management. He would probably be entered into a very comprehensive treatment regimen, have inpatient treatment or part-time inpatient for several weeks, would have intensive rehabilitation processes, all that paid for by the sickness funds, and there might be a small role for opioids, at least for a short period of time in that, but most often it would not.
A lot of people are saying that it's, you know, painkillers, this new epidemic, they're tying it to the increase of opioids, prescription drugs. Is that fair? Can we say that?
I think that's definitely unfair, and I think there is a great danger that this leads to patients in the US suffering because they will not be allowed access to opioids. So right now, already first federal states have gone back to shorter prescription times for opioids. We are proud that we have extended the prescription duration so that patients can have to up to 30 days of opioids on one prescription. And in some of the US states, this has gone down to 7 days now. So patients will have to have refills quite frequently. And if they are bedridden and severely ill, then this might be difficult for them.
If you could advise Donald Trump and the United States on what the country should do to address this opioid crisis, what would you say?
Well, get a social security system. So I think, I mean, having discussed this a lot with my U.S. partners in different commissions and groups, I think it really is such a difference whether you have a complete social security system with appropriate health care for everybody or whether everybody has to pay for himself. And then it becomes a matter of what you spend your money for.
Throughout the week, Germans have appeared, well, kind of a bit tired. And if you're wondering whether it's the cooler weather up here in the northern climates, maybe that's part of it, but it's not just that. So why would Germans be stumbling around looking sluggish and generally acting like zombies? Well, what happened was that all the clocks suddenly sprung back by 1 hour in the middle of the night, placing the country on what's known as winter time. So this is all part of the biannual time switch. Many countries do. It's called daylight savings. You might have it in your country. But in spite of the purported economic benefits for countries, many are now paying more attention to the health costs. Dave Keating has this report on why Poland, and possibly the entire EU as a result, might soon opt out of daylight savings.
There's nothing quite like a sunny summer evening, especially in Europe. Because of its very northern position on the globe, in summer the sun sets far later in Europe than it does in other areas of the world. In Berlin, sunset in July doesn't come until 10 p.m. In Stockholm, it doesn't set till 11. The positioning of the Earth gets part of the credit for these long summer nights, but in many countries, including all the countries of the European Union, the effect is heightened by daylight savings time. These countries move the clocks forward 1 hour for the summer months in order to give more daylight late in the day. But a group of lawmakers in the European Parliament this week launched a push to end this practice, saying it has few benefits and causes negative health and economic effects.
It affects humans, especially light sleepers, people with autism. It affects animals, wild animals, and it affects cows in terms of milk production.
That's Sean Kelly, a member of the European Parliament from Ireland. He's also a member of the Working Group Against the Biannual Clock Change, which wants the European Commission to introduce a law ending the practice of daylight savings time in the European Union. For years now, the MEPs in the group have been holding press conferences in the European Parliament twice a year on the week before the clock change, repeating their call. It might sound like a pipe dream, but at this year's press conference, the mood suddenly changed. For the first time, the Parliament is set to introduce a resolution calling for the change. That's because a new law in Poland may be about to put this issue on the front burner. The government there wants to end daylight savings time in Poland, and a law to that effect is working its way through the legislative process. There's only one problem. Under EU law, they are forbidden from ending DST. That's because a 2001 EU law called the Summertime Directive requires all EU member states to start and end daylight savings time on the same 2 days every year. The countries are free to be in whatever time zone they want, but they have to put their clocks forward for the summer months. If Poland does adopt this law, it will force the EU to react. Should it change the EU law to allow countries to individually opt out of DST? Or should it instead require all countries to follow Poland's example and end DST everywhere? These MEPs want everyone to end it.
We are trying to put together a resolution which will compel the European Commission to come forward with a proposal which would be applicable right across the European Union, because one member state can change if the others don't change.
The biannual change has been shown to have negative effects on both humans and animals. The milk production of cows is disrupted because it takes time to adjust to being milked earlier, leading to an estimated loss of earnings of up to 10%. Studies have shown that car accidents in the United States rise by 30% in the week following the change. Schools have reported increased behavioral problems in children during that week, and researchers have observed an increased risk of heart attacks in women and elderly people in the days following the time change. The public's attitude toward the practice has not been extensively studied in Europe, but a recent study in Germany found that 74% of Germans do not like the practice. Not everyone in the European Parliament is keen on the idea of ending DST. Seb Dance, a British member of the Parliament, says getting rid of daylight savings time would be a terrible idea.
I think summertime is one of the greatest inventions, simplest ideas for improving quality of life, because it shifts daylight from the morning when most people aren't up in the summer, 3, 4 a.m., to the evening when everybody, most people, are out and about. So my worry is if we stay on permanent winter time, which is, I think, what some of the proponents of abolishing the clock change want, is that we'll end up in a situation where we lose those wonderful late, long summer evenings and we end up with light mornings, which effectively occur in the middle of the night, which won't be any use to anyone.
He also doubts the health claims made by the other MEPs.
I love the kind of inference that if you change your clocks a lot, you're going to suffer from health problems, because if that's the case, then MEPs from UK, Ireland, Portugal would suffer from having to change their clocks twice a week. And if the health effects that they've outlined are a significant risk for us, then I think we all are in trouble.
Dance also says that a decision to end DST would lead to an inevitable conflict between those who want to stay on summertime year-round and those who want to stay on wintertime. It would be the battle of the night owls versus the early risers. For now, all eyes are on Warsaw to see if the Poles will force the issue. In Strasbourg, Dave Keating, DW.
Now, does all German science actually happen in Germany? Well, of course not. You've got German scientists all over the globe. They're examining insects, they're looking into volcanoes, they're drilling into meteorite impact zones, and they're generally looking at and listening to the universe all the time. But there's also an agency right here in Germany that kind of intentionally projects its projects, some of them scientific, to other countries in the world. Now, the name of this agency won't actually tell you that much. It's called the GIZ, or the German Corporation for International Cooperation. But its mission will make a bit more sense once you look into some of the projects they support in countries around the world. One of them that's happening right now is taking place in Costa Rica, where the GIZ is meeting one-on-one with individual coffee farmers. Katja Dünner has this report, told here by Neil King, on what the GIZ is trying to persuade these coffee farmers to do.
Leaning over a row of four cups of steaming coffee, a lab technician breathes in the fragrant aroma of a fresh brew before spooning out a sample and swishing it across his taste buds. Satisfied, he spits it out into a travel mug before reaching for the next cup. In this stark, brightly lit lab at the Costa Rica Coffee Institute, or eCafe, scientists subject the country's famed export to extensive quality control testing. They're also working to further improve the coffee and make it more climate friendly. Farmers sent samples of ailing plants to the institute, where scientists look for efficient treatments, such as more ecologically sound fertilizers. On nearby test fields, new types of plants are developed and grown in long rows. Emilia Acosta, a young woman who works with Germany's GIZ Development Agency, points out a promising new plant from Brazil with an unusually large number of small, tightly packed green beans.
Esto son plantaciones de 3 años. Esto es toda la cosecha que tiene.
These are the 3-year-old plants. This is the entire harvest. This isn't normal for one of our traditional plants. Usually they need longer to produce so many coffee beans. And the leaves are bigger, nearly double the size of traditional leaves. And they're very tough. That helps deter fungus infections from developing quickly.
Acosta's job is to introduce farmers to the improved ecological practices.
Besides using these plants, they also need to change how they cultivate them. They have to increase the distance between the plants, change the fertilizer, and provide more shade. Those are big changes. Most start with small steps. The project is quite innovative. No one else is doing it yet. We hope that the production methods will allow coffee farmers to market their product as something unique, unlike any other coffee in the world.
Acosta regularly travels to coffee plantations, visiting with farmers and leading workshops teaching new climate-friendly production methods. Today she's meeting a group of local coffee growers at a smaller plantation in Orosi, in central Costa Rica. Coffee farmer Cecilia Genes understands the need for these new methods. She explains that this year the harvest was already well underway during the rainy season, 3 months early.
We're well aware of climate change. We didn't used to start harvesting until September. This year it was June. That's incredible.
As a young farmer straps on a fertilizer spreader, a backpack with a blue and orange canister attached to a hose, Acosta says if they learn to spray more efficiently, they will produce less damaging greenhouse gases. Most emissions come from fertilizer, especially nitrogen fertilizer. Today, they're practicing with water to learn proper dosages and how to cover a hectare of coffee plants most efficiently.
Café, café.
Later on, the farmers gather in the shade of a large tree along the edge of the coffee field. An instructor explains how they can keep CO2 emissions low by planting large shade trees around their crops.
50% del tronco, más o menos, es puro carbono.
This trunk contains about 50% carbon, and the tree is constantly growing through the process of photosynthesis. That means it absorbs carbon from the atmosphere through its leaves in the form of CO2. As it grows year after year, it absorbs more and more carbon. Some trees absorb more than others. The ones with dense wood are best.
Acosta says the farmers are sometimes hesitant to try the new techniques, but are ready to learn.
The coffee farmers are always curious and want to know more and more. Sometimes they're skeptical of new methods, but they're willing to try. They say, maybe in that small corner over there, I'll try it and see if it works. And so, step by step, they're learning by doing. And then they go to a neighbor and say, look what I've done. I didn't think it would work, but it's super.
Mira, hice esto y pensé que no iba a funcionar, pero está funcionando súper bien, entonces qué chiva.
Oscar Chacon has been an organic coffee farmer for many years. On a walk through his dense coffee field, he shows off the lush, dark green plants with a big smile.
Uno se siente orgulloso de que...
You feel proud when your plants look like this, When a coffee producer sees such plants, he's happy.
Se siente feliz.
He bends over and scoops up a handful of dark, rich soil. Because of the many shade trees and weeds, the ground has become more fertile.
Estos son hongos.
These are fungi and microorganisms, organic materials that break down and decay. It comes from leaves that fall from the trees. They contain calcium, magnesium, and other materials. That means the land nourishes itself with the organic material.
Chacon has been using environmentally friendly practices for years now. It's hoped that within 2 years, an additional 6,000 coffee farmers will join him. That would bring Costa Rica one step closer to its goal of being carbon neutral by 2021.
Across the Northern Hemisphere, residents and tourists are heading to the forest to be dazzled by a natural annual event that only happens during the autumn. That is the turning of the leaves. The scarlet reds, the bright oranges, the yellows, and all sorts of other colors are an outward sign of what's actually going on inside the tree as it shuts itself down and bundles itself up for the winter. Now, there's a lot we know about why and how this happens, but still many questions remain. Sean Griffiths went looking for answers in the forests of Ottawa, Canada.
The fallen leaves drift by my window. The autumn leaves of red and gold.
It's a perfect autumn day. The sun is bright, the skies are blue and clear, and the air is crisp and clean. This all provides an ideal setting for a tour in a city forest ablaze with color. Our tour guide today is Owen Clarkin, known as Ottawa's tree champion.
Okay, so who's ready to look at some trees? Everybody? Let's do it. Okay, so we'll go in this way.
Good weather and an impressive range of naturally generated colors have drawn a 60-strong crowd here to Ottawa's Hampton Park Forest. Some people, armed with cameras, have even brought their dogs along for this urban safari.
So the really, really bright colors we're seeing are mostly maples, right? You probably already know that. The two maples that are the best for color that we're seeing are sugar and red. The sugars are often turning kind of yellowish, orangish, a little bit of red. The red maples, as the name sort of implies, often turn kind of a brilliant scarlet red.
Owen says that, as a conservationist, this is the best time of year to identify trees.
So there are some leaves on the ground. That's basswood. Right here. So this is American elm leaf. They're like sort of oval shaped with sharp teeth. Looks like sort of like a saw blade teeth. So this is a great time of year to identify trees because there's leaves all over the place. You've got, say, basswood. You've got sugar maple. You've got whatever. But you look under. This is American elm here. It's not a very good one. That's American elm.
Though he has been exploring forests for years, he says there is much we don't know about why and how leaves turn color. To find out more, I met with Ken Farr at the Dominion Arboretum. He's a dendrologist, someone who studies trees with the Canadian Forestry Service.
The trees, as they need to lose leaves because their tissues will freeze in the winter, they can't be carried through. Leaves form a little suberized layer at the base of the leaf stalk that cuts the leaf off from the tree itself. And at the same time, the chlorophyll is being removed from the leaves, and the outside process we see is color change.
But this is about conserving energy coming into winter, isn't it?
It's saving energy and essentially losing the parts of the tree that would not survive through the winter.
During the growing seasons, chlorophyll, a pigment, means the leaves will be green. But as the tree prepares for winter and that chlorophyll begins to break down, other underlying pigments begin to become more visible. What we witness as a changing in leaf color is simply the outward expression of this process. As chlorophyll is stripped away, the underlying pigments, carotenes, which express as orange, and xanthophylls, which express as yellow, in the white birch, for example, come to the fore. But what about those trees whose leaves turn such a vivid red? They look like they are on fire.
Right now I'm looking at a red maple leaf. This bright red, almost a purple color, is anthocyanin. Anthocyanin is dissolved in the sap of the tree, and it gets trapped in the leaf, if you will, as the leaf is starting to be shut off. And with a little sunlight, a little cool temperature at night, it drives a physiological reaction that produces these beautiful bright red or purple colors. Red maple, it's named for the red, very bright red leaves in the autumn.
And just to complicate things further, Michael Runtz, a naturalist with Carleton University's Department of Biology, says that gender has a role to play in maple trees.
Most maple trees have flowers in the spring that contain both sexes. They're both male and female. Red maples are different. Some trees only have male flowers, and other trees only have female flowers. The intriguing part is, in the fall, the female trees turn yellow in leaf color, while the males turn red. Yeah, and there are spectacular reds.
Do we know why one gender turns one color and another gender turns another?
That's a $1 million question. No, that's a tremendous question.
But scientists understand that certain conditions do have to be present for the leaves to kick off their annual color transformation. Ken Farr.
Color change itself is triggered by day length, or more precisely in the autumn, by shortening of days and lengthening of nights. And that makes sense, because what else can a tree measure? You know, it was often thought that it was colder days that would produce the change in leaves, and that plays a role, but there's no way for a tree to actually be sensate to that.
And Dr. Farr says trees do this because there is an evolutionary benefit to conserving energy. But scientists are still baffled as to why the trees turn such bright, vivid red colors.
It's hard to say what is the evolutionary gain to a tree to produce that color. It's not apparently producing sunshade for the tree. It's not producing. It's not capturing light electrons to produce foods and structural materials. It could be that the bright colors, particularly the reds, are sort of a signal to insects that you shouldn't chew on this leaf because there could be something bad there. More to find out.
Others have very different theories of what the changing of leaf colors means. Back in Hampton Park Forest, two women on Owen Clarkin's tree tour drew spiritual lessons on what the death of leaves in such a blaze of color told them about life.
Yeah, when it's fall and all the colors are changing, and it's amazing to me that they're basically dying for the winter, and this is so beautiful. Like, the death in this area, in the forest, is just glamorous, it's glorious. Yeah.
It's because they want to focus humans' attention on the joy of living and how before we die, we need to be radiant. We need to show all of our colors to the world.
When autumn leaves start to fall.
Well, that brings this broadcast to a close for today. A special thanks to my technician, Max Zimmer, and to you, all of our listeners, for tuning in. I sincerely hope you come back next time for our next episodes. We've got more in the works, some really good stuff coming up. So until then, and on behalf of all my colleagues from the SciTech department, have a wonderful week ahead.